Welcome to Third Floor Views, a production of Chesapeake Family Life, where we talk about health, education, and living with kids. I'm your host, Laura Boycourt. Today, we'll be talking about growing your own food, from the nutritional benefits to the process to the recipes, all of which is featured in Kayla Butts' new Garden to Table cookbook. Thank you, Kayla, for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura. I really appreciate the time.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really excited to get into this with you as a mom and having young kids and just someone, you know, a 40-something with a 40-something husband looking to improve our nutrition and health. This is a real interest to me. So it's a pleasure that that I'm able to talk to you today.
Thank you. Same here. All of the above.
Perfect. So let's start with a little bit about you, your background. You're a registered dietitian nutritionist and a registered dietitian. So can you tell us a little bit about those? Maybe I was a little bit redundant. Maybe there's some crossover there. Can you explain those to listeners and viewers?
Absolutely. I wear many hats. And when we just were visiting with each other before we hit record, I said pretty much my entire life revolves around food, and that's true. So I always sort of hesitate to tell people I'm a dietitian because there's that misconception that I'm going to judge what you're eating. You know, I see them hide the hamburgers and the French fries, but really my goal is to help people understand how the food they eat affects their bodies. And, you know, God just blessed me with a husband that has the same goal. He actually left a really successful corporate job, bought a plot of land in a place where it's not very easy to grow food, and decided to become a pioneer farmer. And we've shared in that crazy journey for the last decade plus. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we've just learned a lot about how growing your own food can really not only empower your health, but bring you closer to your family, to your community, and have just so many benefits that I talk about in the book. And I love sharing how easy it can be. Because I think as humans, we complicate everything. We have to make it harder than it really needs to be. But really how easy it can be to start your own garden, to grow your own food, cook it, preserve it, and to make delicious recipes from it.
You're fantastic. And I can tell that you're very passionate about this. So going into your book, I can sort of answer this question myself, but what inspired you to write it? I can tell your passion and then having that land, seeing how it worked for you and your husband, what made you think, okay, let's write a book about this?
Absolutely. The passion is definitely there. And I've always really believed that we as humans crave a deeper connection to our food. And unfortunately, as our food system has changed, we've really lost that connection. I mean, it really is the most profound way that we can support our health every single day. So it's important, right? For millennia, we hunted, we gathered, we grew our own food. Literally, our hands were the only hands that touched our food. But now, you know, there's a scientist in a lab that genetically modifies the seed, and then somebody that packages the seed, and then it gets shipped off, and then a farmer buys the seed, and on and on and on. So there are literally dozens of people that touch our food before our eyes even get set on it. So interestingly, through our farming experience, I got approached by more and more people saying, you know, I just want to grow my own food. I just, I want to live off the land. You know, there's just something so wholesome about what you do. And so I felt the need for that. And that was really compounded with COVID. I'm sure, you know nothing about COVID. It didn't affect your life at all, right? So it was just that crazy experience of going into a grocery store and there were empty shelves. And we really had a front row view into how precarious our food system is. And it was scary. It was scary for me. And I know it was scary for a lot of my friends and family. So I wanted to share how growing your own food can really be some of the most empowering things that you can do for you and your family. I really feel like it's a gift, and I wanted others to be able to experience it.
No, that sounds exactly right. Because if you think about it, there's such power that comes from that, not just because when there's an experience like COVID and the grocery store shelves are bare, you know, well, that immediate need, the immediacy of needing food, but just empowering is exactly right. So I'm thrilled that you wrote this. And I do love the book. So I'm excited for other people to learn a little bit more about it. So let's talk about nutrition. What does the American diet right now look like? And of course, this isn't, you know, a one size fits all. You know, we've got lots of people with different needs, different sort of things that they have to keep in mind, you know, medical reasons, conditions for their specific diet. But I guess the standard average American diet, what does it look like and what's wrong with it?
I'm so glad you bring this up, Laura. So the standard American diet, SAD, is frankly sad for most of us. And you've probably heard that before, but first of all, we eat a lot more than we used to. In fact, we eat 23% more today than we did in the 1970s, about 50 years ago. And I believe that's because most of our food is devoid of the nutrition that we need to feel satisfied. You know, our evolution is such that we crave the foods, not only that are addictive, ultra processed and delicious, but we crave the foods that nourish us. You know, that's in our DNA from years and years of living off the land. But unfortunately, most of our diets don't look like that anymore. The majority of the American diet comes from refined grains and inflammatory seed oils. There was an article in CNN by their chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and I love this article. He titles it, "If Americans Are What We Eat, We're Corn and Soy."
I did see that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. See that one? Oh, so profound. So he actually had a plant scientist at Berkeley test one of his strands of hair. And it turns out that 69% of the carbon from that single strand of his hair was composed of the same carbon from corn.
That's
wild. So literally 70%. Yeah. And I mean, he's a neurologist. He is like a world renowned physician. He's really watching his diet and watching what he eats, but corn is in everything. So is soy. 10% of our diet is soy. And it's really not our fault. We're not going out and saying, "Hey, I'm going to eat a big thing of edamame today and I'm going to have a nice crisp, kernel of corn."
It's inherent in everything, right?
I mean, exactly. It's in our oils. It's in our, you know, it's additives at lecithin, emulsifiers. I mean, the types of derivatives that they've come from these two products are just, it's amazing. It's really astounding. I mean, it's a scientific marvel, but it's not doing much for our health. And then another major component of our diet is sugar. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us kind of realize that it's kind of gotten out of hand because we're finally headed in the right direction. We've cut down on our sugar consumption somewhat in the past few years, but the average American still eats 77 pounds of sugar a year. That's about 23 teaspoons of sugar per day. So if you can imagine putting 23 teaspoons of sugar in your coffee, that's what we're feeding our children. Is that crazy? I mean, it's just crazy. And you know, it's in a lot of foods that we eat that we think we're eating something nutritious, say yogurt. If you get a fruit flavored yogurt, that is packed full of sugar. I've seen over 20 grams of sugar in a serving. Marinara sauce, another, you want to make a nice little puttanesca and gosh, the added sugar is out the door. I've even seen sugar in bacon today. So it's just crazy.
No, that was possible. There you go.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, how can you make bacon better? Add some sugar. So we literally eat 1100 calories per day just from added fats. And these are not the kind of fats that help our brain or that our bodies really like. It's inflammatory fats that have been shown to lead to chronic disease like heart attacks and strokes. And then that added sugar. And the clincher is the scientific community, the medical community, we all know it's bad for us. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are, the food pyramid still recommends those as some of the top two nutrients to get in your body. It's just, it's very interesting what's going on with our food system.
No, absolutely. And we should say with these choices of, garden to table and gardening, growing your own food, you're not advocating for restricting your diet. You're not advocating for, you know, anything that, you know, counting calories, things like that. You're advocating for healthier options. I think that's important to say, you know, because there's a big difference, right, between, you know, the restriction and the calorie counting and things like that versus, okay, well, getting those satiating foods from, you know, more natural sort of resources and processes and things like that, which is just important, I think, to point out. So we've got a pretty clear understanding of what the SAD diet looks like. And this is, you know, sort of something that you touched on, but what should change? You know, what are the biggest ways that we should change, look to change our diets?
Well, Laura, you put it beautifully. And gosh, these are like the hard hitting questions. I mean, yeah. How much time do we have? Because I could really get in the loop here. But the main problem with the food system, as I see it, and you said it best, I'm not advocating that we have a super restrictive diet and we just get crazy with what we're eating. What I would love is if we could create an environment where it makes it easier to eat the foods that are going to love us back and to nourish our bodies. And unfortunately, the main goal of our food system is not to nourish Americans. We've gotten far from that. And to really understand how we've gotten where we are, we really need a little bit of a history lesson on our agriculture. So most of us can remember in the 70s, there was that initial farm bill that passed. And that was during a time when farmers were really struggling. The idea of a famine or food scarcity was a real threat. And so government came in and tried to help. And in doing so, they created commodity crop distinction. So farmers that grow commodity crops, wheat, corn, soy, canola, you're hearing a lot of the same terms that I've been using. They are given basically a government bailout. If the prices, the bottom drops out on the prices, they're able to get assistance, additional assistance for growing these commodity crops. In addition, they can also qualify for extra loans and help. So as you can imagine, the farmers that grow these commodity crops have a lot more incentives than the farmers that grow specialty crops, like, for instance, other fruits and vegetables. Another thing that's happened is that some really effective herbicides were created, things like Roundup, glyphosate. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we genetically modified these seeds so they can withstand that herbicide without dying. You know, if our ancestors put a bunch of Roundup on their corn, it would have died immediately. Yeah. So in short, really what's happened is the most easy to grow incentive-rich foods to grow are these commodity crops, and they turned into the most processed foods. They're the cheapest on the market because they have the most competition. And really they're fed to our cows and our chickens. They're converted into the meat that we eat. They're processed into sodas, fast food, frozen meals. I mean, literally thousands of food products. And then food scientists manipulate them to create the most delicious, addictive foods that our bodies, they literally have, it's crazy. They literally have taste buds in a petri dish and they stimulate them until they find what's called the bliss point. And it's like, yeah, I mean, no wonder, once you stop, you can't stop, I mean, because they make the food so palatable that it's absolutely irresistible. And so we're eating more, but we're being less nourished. Mm-hmm. And, from a regulatory standpoint, the panel behind our food guide pyramid, unfortunately, has ties to those same companies that are producing the processed foods. And I don't want to be conspiracy theorists here. I just think as consumers, we have the right to know. Sure. And food manufacturers spend more than $18 million per year on lobbying our government. So, our government has to answer to their, our government officials, they have their farm constituencies that they have to answer to. And they've also got these deep pockets that are helping to support them. So there's a lot of things going on.
A lot of play there. A lot of wrong with the country's food system that you outlined really well. And a lot of that's surprising to me, the science behind it all. It's you don't want to liken it to cigarettes. That's like, apples to oranges, but in a way, it's like we're being sort of trained in a way to crave these things. So that makes a lot of sense, the way you put it. So to get into your book, growing, freezing, preserving, gardening, why is that a more sensible choice, in terms of everything that you've been talking about, the American diet, how are all the things that you advocate for in your book? Why are those a better choice?
So interestingly, the fruits and vegetables that sit on our grocery store shelves were not grown with our health in mind. So the species of produce that we choose today are chosen because they can grow quicker. They're resistant to those pests. They're resistant to those herbicides. So for example, we have varieties of squash that have thicker skins, so we can package and ship them. We have corn that has a higher sugar content, so we can make it into high fructose corn syrup. We have apples that have a certain shape and size, so they can fit perfectly into the container, so they can be shipped across the country. A study by Dr. Davis out of UT, which is my alma mater, he found out that he measured produce in 1999 and compared it to the same produce from 1975. On average, that produce had 27% less calcium, 37% less iron, 21% less vitamin A, and 30% less vitamin C.
Goodness.
So it's crazy how the methods of our food growing, not only the poor nutrients of our soil, but also how we're choosing these certain fruits and vegetables for these characteristics have really affected the nutritional content. If I can get a little sciencey,
sure.
The sole source of nutrition in a food comes from the soil. So when you pick that tomato off a vine, when it's still green, it's already got all the nutrients it will ever have. Then should you ship that across the country, you know, because they're not growing tomatoes in Canada, it's going to lose all of its water-soluble vitamins, the vitamin C, riboflavin, niacin, B12. And even more, it's going to lose more nutrients when it's sitting there ripening on the grocery store shelf. And we wonder why our produce is so tasteless.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that when you grow that same tomato in a nutrient-rich soil without chemicals, you maximize the amount of health-promoting phytochemicals in that plant. And the reason being is because the same nutrients that we enjoy in that tomato, the lycopene, the antioxidants, those phytochemicals come from its own immune system. So when a plant bites the tomato the leaf of the tomato plant, or even tomato hornworms are my arch nemesis. But if there's an assault on that tomato, it will increase its immunity by pumping out all these phytochemicals. And those are the same chemicals that make that tomato red and delicious and taste good and help our immune system. So it's just this amazing circle that if we as humans don't mess with it too much, it works perfectly. But it's when we try to go in and add all these crazy chemicals and genetically modify everything that the system gets, you know, out of whack. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the most antioxidant, healthiest food that we have ever found is Tartary buckwheat, which is grown on the very tip of the Himalayan mountains. Like, so the worst conditions ever, rocky soil, literally on the mountainside, and there's cold wind blowing 24 hours a day. I mean, any person who's ever tried to have a garden knows that these are the worst conditions. But this plant has survived all of those micro stresses and in the process become one of the healthiest plants that you can eat. Wow. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy how, you know, we've messed it up, but it's still a possibility to get there.
So it sounds like if you're growing your own food and, you know, preserving it, freezing it, things like that for consumption, you're in control of your soil. You're not having those additives. You're not having, you know, these modified conditions that, you know, make the fruit, vegetables, whatever, become devoid of what your body really needs. So when you're doing it at home under the right conditions, you're doing yourself a big favor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? As I mentioned before, it doesn't have to be complicated. All you really need is a place in your yard that gets 6 to 8 hours of direct sunlight. And the rest is pretty simple, you know, things that that are pretty straightforward. You know, if you're wanting to start out, I would recommend being honest with yourself. I wouldn't go crazy and try to plant a huge garden. A little 3 foot by 5 foot bed is all you really need. And a lot of people feel like, oh, I need to make a raised bed and build something really pretty. Honestly, if you want to, you can, but that's not necessary to grow the food. Mm-hmm. And as far as cost goes, we're all trying to make pinch pennies these days with everything that's going on. And the average backyard garden is a pretty substantial 600 square feet. That's a pretty good size. And it only costs about $70. And that can produce 300 pounds of fruits and vegetables and save $600 at the grocery store. So it can be very economical and relatively maintenance free.
Okay. Yeah. So that was sort of my next question that you answered, you know, do it yourself food. It seems like it's not quite as time consuming as some people might think. It's a little bit easier than we might think, and it's cheaper than we might think. So it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, for someone like me who has, you know, relatively, you know, sparse backyard, you know, it can be overwhelming to think, all right, well, if I was going to do this, so just the time, the money, the effort, but it sounds like you can start, you know, at a relatively small scale and, you know, still be successful in the endeavor. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what I really promote in the book is having fun with polyculture. You know, we're used to seeing these rows and rows, beautiful rows of corn, beautiful rows of sorghum. And that's not how nature works. You know, we have symbiosis going on and balance in nature. And that's really the easiest, most fundamental way to have a garden and have it successfully. So I give you a step-by-step, very easy to follow method in my book to where you can start a garden on the weekend and have a productive garden. I give you tips on how to mulch it so that it's weed free. You can lay down drip tape, and it's, you know, now with technology, you set your timer to water every few days. And so literally you just look at your garden out the window and say, oh, there it is. I hope everything's going well. And it will be. It's really kind of self-sustaining if you put the initial inputs in it correctly. So it's very gratifying to see as well when you finally get that harvest.
I'm sure. And since we are a sort of family-centric magazine, you know, catering to the whole family, you know, it sounds like gardening, in my experience, when I was young, I have fond memories with my parents in the backyard. It sounds like it can be a you know, fairly whole family-friendly activity, I would imagine. What are some of the ways that maybe younger kids could get involved? From what you've said, it sounds like, you know, there are lots of options for them, you know, maybe helping till some soil, plant some seed, you know, drop some seeds in, things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have involved my children in every step of the process, and you will be surprised at how passionate they get about growing their food. They can plant seeds, water the garden, help weed if you need them to, harvest the vegetables, even prepare them, you know, cook them. They have kid-friendly chef's knives, so they can, you know, chop vegetables or pull apart lettuce leaves. And I find that my kids are much more open-minded to trying new things, especially when it comes to vegetables, when they've had a hand in growing them or cooking them even. And they seem to have much more of an appreciation for the food that they have when they've had a stake in growing it as well. So even when they were teeny tiny, they loved scooting around the garden. And one of their favorites was, as you can imagine, raking up leaves, because yep, then they got to jump in it afterwards and make a big mess.
Yes, absolutely. My kids love that too. And to your point, you know, it's, even though we don't currently have a garden, but that's going to change after talking to you today. You know, just having their little the plastic, you know, cut safe knives, being able just to cut some zucchini or, you know, some lettuce, some tomatoes, they're so much more invested in it. And they're so much, you know, they're proud of what they've done, and they're much more likely to eat those vegetables. So absolutely, I think it's a win-win for everyone in the family.
Definitely. And there's so many lessons that they can learn from the garden. I mean, just about the ecosystem and how everything plays an important role. You know, one of the best things that we've learned along the way is how everything balances everything out. My daughter had a fear of bees, and when she finally realized what an important pollinator they were, now she loves bees because she knows that that's one of the most important species we have for our food system.
Right. So it's a great teaching tool as well for the ecosystem and just the environment and, you know, our planet at large, which is wonderful. And as we wrap up, I didn't want to let you get away without asking for some of your favorite recipes from the book. If you could share maybe one or two family-friendly recipes that you're a big fan of.
Oh gosh, Laura, you ask all hard questions. Man, I have so many. So family-friendly, gosh. Some days when I'm tired, I really gravitate towards the no fuss kind of recipes, like a gazpacho or a Dutch baby. That's one of my kids' favorites. Yep. I mean, who wouldn't like a giant pancake with a lot of yummy berries, summer berries on top? I love to travel when I can. And so international flavors are some of my favorites. There's this beautiful tzatziki potato salad that I would love for you to try. So easy, so delicious. There's also a to die for boxty, Irish boxty, if you've ever had it. It's sort of like a latke, but fluffier. Oh, it's so good. Potato pancake all the way. And then pies are my love language. And so there's a few recipes for pies in there that I always bring out in a pinch, and they're fan favorites for sure. So
fantastic. Well, it's a wonderful book. You know, obviously all of your recipes, your expertise, the photography is beautiful. It's like, you can't read that book without, you know, wanting to go start a garden right away. So thank you so much to Caleb Butts for taking the time to speak with us about the benefits of growing your own food. And thank you to all of our viewers and listeners as well. Make sure you visit ChesapeakeFamily.com for up-to-date local information on home, health, and living for today's Maryland parent. This episode will be archived on ChesapeakeFamily.com in video and podcast format. I'm Laura Boycourt with Chesapeake Family Life and Third Floor Views. Thanks so much for joining us.